Eve Sobriety Powwow on Thursday, December 31st from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Grand entry will be at 1 and 6 p.m. with honorings, Ed Goodell as the whip man, Nara All Nations Drum as the host drum, and MC Philip Archambault. Again, that's the Nara New Year's Eve Sobriety Powwow, Thursday, December 31st from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center, Hall A and B, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundations and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
This is Kristen Yount for KBOO Radio. I was in attendance at the Renters Emergency Panel, which took place on December 15th, 2015, at the Community Warehouse. The panel was put on by Community Warehouse, Know Your City, and the Portland Tenants Union. Panelists included Katrina Holland of the Community Alliance of Tenants, Margot Black from the Portland Tenants Union, Vahid Brown from Hazelnut Grove, Josh Alpert, who is Mayor Charlie Hales' chief of staff, and Meg Guerrera of Hacienda CDC.
His name was Van Rensselaer. He became one of the richest men on earth. In today's terms, $90 billion is how much he'd be worth. All this for doing nothing, but saying all of this was his. I have the power of the state behind me, and I'm in landlord biz. After 200 years of this and one revolution won, another Van Rensselaer.
Also, there was a pretty stealthy appearance by Dee Robix, who sang this song about landlords, and Michelle DePass from the Portland Housing Authority moderated the panel. You'll be hearing excerpts from interviews that I did before the panel and actual content from the panel. This first excerpt is from Meg Guerrera, who is part of Hacienda CDC, which is a low-income housing affiliate. And this is what she had to say about capping rents.
In the market rate, if the renters will know more about how they can keep their housing, what are their rights, it will be better. Cap for market rent houses, at this point in Portland, I think that it's needed. It's going crazy. There are houses, one bedroom rented for $1,200. It's incredible.
And also, it goes with saying, without saying, that $1,200, 500 square foot apartment, even if it's newly built, displace somebody in the market who is already paying rent in the market, don't you think?
Yeah, basically, you know, and our the majority of our housing is located in the colored neighborhood, mm-hmm. and we are seeing that in houses. You know, people cannot afford to pay the rent anymore. They are being evicted from their homes, and I will think that if the city wants to protect these people, they need to create some rules, some clear rules about what is the cap that an owner can put in a home, mm-hmm. so they can rent it.
And just one more time, tell us briefly what Hacienda CDC does.
Sure. Hacienda CDC is a Latino organization. We pretty much serve Latinos, but people of color. We build houses, we manage through a third party. We manage our own housing, affordable housing. We also have some other services as a resident service, youth and family service, and home ownership.
And so what are the government agencies that you work with for funding and for things like that, just so people can get an idea?
We work with several organizations as Oregon Housing and Community Service, Rural Development, which is a federal organization, and cities, the City of Portland, the Bureau of Housing, and the City of, in our case, we are in Molalla too. So we have a small project over there, 25 units.
So if people want to get a hold of you, what is the best way to find out more about Hacienda CDC?
Website is always a good way to learn about us, but we also have a phone number that I don't have with me right now, but I will get it. you can call me and I can give you the I can guide you in how to apply and rent in one of our housing. I must say that vacancies in affordable housing are really, really rare.
What is your waiting list like right now?
Because we have to clean up our waiting list, sometimes goes to 150, 200 people. That could last a time of 2 years, 1 year, 2 years, it depends.
So just how many units do you have?
We have 381 units. Like I say, most of them located in the Cooley neighborhood, mm-hmm. One property located in Molalla.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any hope to maybe be able to build more affordable housing?
I have hope, yes. I think that should be the main goal of meetings like this, of mm-hmm. forums like this, to not pressure, I will say, but to communicate with our government and to clarify that affordable housing is needed, especially to not push away communities of colors and low-income families.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Also, I got to speak with Margot Black of Portland Renters United, a renters union. I'm here with Margot Black. She is on the panel tonight. We're talking about no-cause eviction. We're talking about rent increase. And I know that this panel is sort of a response to another panel. Can you tell us what we're all doing here tonight?
Well, we had conspired for this panel before finding out about the Oregonians panel, but then it became a response to a panel last week hosted by the Oregonians editorial board. Or Oregon Media Group, of concerned citizens who met in downtown Portland, and those concerned citizens were mostly elected officials and developers and other stakeholders in the housing process. Notably absent were any people who were actually experiencing the rent crisis personally. So this is our opportunity to put both, you know, renters, also women, people of color on the panel to talk about what it's like on the ground and why we think this, why we're in a rent crisis and what we think should be done about it.
All right. So what do you think? I mean, Margot, you've been like you've been around a lot lately, but why don't you just outline for me what your idea of a tenants union is?
Well, I think as a renter in Portland since 1996, I have mostly felt a lack of power and agency. I've felt like a lot of parts of the experience have just been very dehumanizing. In my last no-cause eviction, I was told I shouldn't be upset about it because I was just a renter. And so I see a tenants union as being a way to organize for tenant power. You know, we are not a group of people who, for any reason whatsoever, deserve to be subjugated and exploited and price gouged. The rent that we pay every month is the biggest expense, and it's for a needed service of housing and shelter, and the stability and security and safety of that is critical to the well-being of ourselves, our families, our neighborhoods, and our communities. And I think that tenants need a voice around the table, and they need to build their own table and elevate their voices and just demand change. And that's only going to happen if we do it together.
So when you're talking about being a renter and living in a place that, you know, you're paying most of your, it's the biggest bill that you have, and your place is substandard, you maybe have a stove that doesn't work or a leaky faucet, things that seem trivial to somebody who may own hundreds of units, but to you, it's not. How do you feel about the complaint-driven system here in Portland?
Well, I feel like it doesn't work. I feel like, you know, if you're talking about a stove that doesn't work or a leaky faucet, you can call your landlord or your property manager. And best case scenario, you know, they fix it somewhat expediently and everything is fine. And that's great. That's kind of how it's meant to be. But what we are experiencing, and especially for people who are maybe, you know, in units that are possibly below market for whatever market means, is that there's this whole, well, you know, you should just be happy that we haven't kicked you out or that we haven't raised your rent, this expectation that you shouldn't be asking for repairs and you shouldn't, you know, have any expectation that they get performed ever. Of course, there's this fear of asking at all, because should the landlord decide that you're, you know, a pain or they don't want to have to deal with the repair, they can just give you a no-cause eviction, which technically is illegal, but who's enforcing that? Who's checking in on that? What are the tenants' recourses for that? And so I just think that the complaint-based system is just completely dysfunctional. It's like letting the fox watch the hen house.
All right. Well, it looks like things are starting to pick up here, so I'm going to let you go, Margo. This is Margo Black. Michelle DePasse, the moderator, is the engagement and policy coordinator for the Portland Housing Authority. She asked the question, why is the rent so damn high? The 150 or so people in attendance sort of laughed uneasily, and then Mayor Charlie Hales' chief of staff, Josh Alpert, started off with the responses.
There are clearly a billion factors, but the simple answer is that we are a victim of our own success in a lot of ways. We have been faced with and are continuing to face unprecedented levels of growth. And what all the economists tell us are that these are people coming in who like to live in cities. They're not people coming to Oregon to go live in Hillsboro or Tualatin or Lake Oswego. They're coming to live the urban lifestyle. And because we, over time, have built an incredible city that does provide a pretty accessible urban lifestyle, people are coming here in droves. And, you know, particularly what we've been faced a lot with lately are our comrades down in the Bay Area, in LA, even in San Diego, who have found it cheaper to live in Portland and commute to California, either electronically or in by flying down there. And so we are faced with people who have been moving up here who are either working here or moving up here and working elsewhere and either telecommuting or actually going and buying plane tickets and flying down because it's still cheaper than living in those areas. So we have all of that coming and we have more of it coming. We have not done a particularly good job over the past decade or two of keeping up with the housing supply. I think we all probably know that here, and there has been a lot that's happened during the course of the recession, underbuilding affordable housing, of course, underbuilding multifamily housing, and doing a ton of condo conversions where everything all of a sudden just got priced out. So that, of course, becomes a supply-demand issue, and we have a lot of demand and a little supply. So the rents have borne that out through the market.
Thank you. So it sounds like we should avoid the United Terminal like on Monday mornings at 6 o'clock in the morning. Does anybody else want to speak to that? Why is the rent so damn high?
Yeah, I just really briefly, I mean, I think obviously there's a supply demand, and that's, I think, sort of the loudest narrative that our population is growing and that we don't have enough housing, which I would certainly agree with. But I also think that it's high because we can't pay it, because we aren't making enough money. And, you know, our wages haven't grown. And I also think it's high because our landlords are raising it. They aren't actually, it's not that they are forced to raise it. They are making that choice to do it, and they have written into the state law that they are able to do that without any regulation or oversight, and that is why it is so high.
So I definitely have to echo what both have said, particularly from the renter's perspective, what Margo has said, and that people are just able to raise the rents. I mean, I think I saw it was a news story of this landlord who was developing a new property, and he summed it up very beautifully. He said, rents are going up because they can. And so I think, you know, of course we can talk about, you know, the rational actor and economics and, you know, all of the things that the fathers of economics have said for quite some time. But at the end of the day, I kind of like things simplistic, and people make decisions, and a market, housing, decisions, prices, value, the ability to pay, or I shouldn't say the ability to pay, but paying something, are all decisions that people make. People with ideas, with desires, with a mind to do what they please, and policies either hinder or allow that. And so I think that's kind of what we're faced with. You know, people's desire to make money and desire to live here are clashing and are combining to create this exponential price explosion. Not to mention the rise, I mean, of course, I think it's fairly minimal. Granted, I'm not a landlord, so I can't speak to it directly, but there have been some increase in the cost of maintaining housing and in purchasing housing. And so as a result, landlords and developers choose to pass that on to their tenants instead of absorbing the cost for whatever reason. And then, of course, I mean, I also believe in a component. I mean, this is the cynic in me, but I know that there is a component of economic cleansing, unfortunately, you know, an unspoken elephant in the room that we fail to address. And that is, you know, people want to come here and live in this ritzy, high income, beautiful city that excludes other people. And that's unfair. Thank you. Thing I wanted to say. Because we are people, and we can make decisions, both landlords and renters, at the end of the day, even if landlords decided to keep the prices at where they were, people would still purchase, right? People would still pay for it. It would result in a mass shortage, but at the end of the day, people would still pay for it.
Would you like to answer? Yeah. Can you give me your name again, too, please?
Vahid.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, just briefly. You know, from my experience with the campers at Hazelnut Grove, it's organized or it's Lord of the Flies, right? If the rent is too damn high because there's a legal and regulatory environment that favors the landowners, that favors the developers, that favors those who are raising the rent.
Thank you.
They are organized. They have lobbies. They have influence with regulatory and legal environments that, if we're not organized, we don't. So the tenants union, the community alliance of tenants, organized tent camping on the very, you know, ground level, that's organizing to have a counter influence for us that it benefits the residents of this city and not the fat cats that are investing enormous sums to make enormous, you know, profits on this land boom.
Yep. Nick, did you want to speak to why the rents are so damn high?
I want to make clear that I'm in the affordable housing, so we do have caps in our rents. We cannot go as the market rate rent goes. But I do want to make sure that I answer one of the comments that you made about the cost of maintenance of these houses. It's high. For the last 3 years, the cost of water in the city of Portland has been going up 9 and 11%. For us that have a cap in rent, it's almost impossible. Transferring that to the tenants is almost impossible for us. So demand is high.
So just as a follow-on question, maybe the question would be, what are some of the tools we can use to look at making those regulatory changes.
You want to skip to number five?
Right. I'm going to skip here. Because it's relevant in terms of what was just said at the table here.
I mean, obviously, rent stabilization policies, which we usually think of as rent control, and it could be a myriad of things. I mean, what rent control does, at least in the United States, is it regulates the amount of the increase. So when you move into a unit, it may be market rate, and we have to assume in that situation that the person moving in can afford that rate, and that, you know, there may be some flaws in that assumption. But then it can only raise by a set amount each year, which is dependent on some economic indicators like the cost or inflation and CPI. And there are, you know, there are some tools for both landlord and tenant to appeal that if certain things, you know, if costs go up more than the increase or if maintenance doesn't occur. I think what rent stabilization policies are created to keep existing residents in their homes. And it is very successful in that respect. What you're seeing in San Francisco is you're seeing market rate rentals, so those units have been vacated or they have been built after 1978, so they're not even subject to rent control. Those rents are, they're unregulated, and we have income inequality at a pretty profound level in San Francisco, which is driving up those market rate rents. But the people who have not been forced out through the loopholes that California has given in San Francisco called the Ellis Act, those people are paying rents that are still affordable to them. They are able to stay in their communities, they're able to stay in their buildings, they're able to ask for repairs without fear of eviction, and they know that they'll be able to afford their rent forever, and I think that's a really powerful policy. We have to understand what that really means when we talk about it. Vacancy control is what limits the amount of the increase after a unit turns over. That was on the books in California for a few years in the early phases of the legislation. Landlords voted it out, and that is what has really kind of disrupted the market forces down there.
Thank you. So I'm gonna move on. So the city has declared a state of housing emergency. What does that mean? Explain to the audience what that means to each of you. I mean, maybe starting, and Katrina, I would love to hear from you. Vahid, do you have any input?
Sure, I'll start. Well, I know for Kat, we declared the renter state of emergency in September. For us, it really meant a significant or exponential uptick in the number of no-cause evictions and rent increases that were being reported to us on our hotline. So,
excuse me.
Yeah, sure.
So once the state of emergency was put in place at the council level, your calls went up after that or prior to that?
The day before.
Okay.
Yeah, the day before. When we declared the renter state of emergency on September 15, 2015, September 16, 2015 is when Commissioner Saltzman released his 90-day ordinance proposal. So we also saw a dramatic increase in homelessness. I mean, we've all seen that and have experienced it. It's extremely unfortunate, especially in African American populations where it's increased. I believe it's 48% within the last couple years. And according to Multnomah County's point in time count, so we know that there's data equity issues there, but these rent increases and no cause evictions and homelessness continues to go up at a very rapid pace that's causing wide displacement, mass displacement. And at the end of the day, people are struggling on a massive scale to find, maintain, and find and maintain housing, which essentially undermines people's economic stability, because you have to have a house, essentially, or a place to live in order to get a license. You have to have an address to be able to be tracked, I guess you could say, when you're applying for a job. And so it's really undermining that economic stability. And the other elephant in the room is this housing state emergency is kind of indicative of a housing bubble that could burst. Particularly in multifamily, we call it the gold rush mentality. That's kind of being enacted right now. That could be similar to what's in 2008.
I've heard that term being used in this context. So thank you. So when we say state of emergency, Josh, can you speak to what that means from a
city
perspective?
Just to be clear, two different things kind of getting at the same issue. Kat worked with the community on a renter state of emergency about a month before city council declared a city state of emergency around housing and homelessness. The idea from the city perspective, truly, this is how this happened. I was sitting on my couch one night, may or may not have been drinking whiskey, and was having this conversation with my wife, and she was saying, well, it is an emergency out there, right? I said, yeah. She said, well, aren't people saying, you know, where's Mercy Corps? Where's the Red Cross? That's what we do when there's emergencies. And I said, yeah, they're not particularly interested in helping in this. She said, well, there's got to be something that can be done through the city code. So I opened up the city code and went to the emergency provisions. And sure enough, a natural disaster state of emergency fit everything that we're going through here in the city of Portland. And I thought, okay, great. Something here seems to make sense. What does that actually allow us to do? We are now, about two, almost 3 months into the state of emergency, and we're still finding out what that actually does mean. When we drafted the ordinance, the resolution to bring to council, we actually changed code to write into the definition that housing is a criteria to declare an emergency, which now forevermore can be triggered and used by city council. Just to clarify, because we knew we would be sued pretty immediately on a bunch of the stuff we were working on. So we bolstered our case legally and then wrote the ordinance very narrowly to say that all this does is waive a couple of things. It waives the procurement process so that when we want to say, hey, Cascadia Behavioral Health, we're going to pay you to go out and work with those who have the highest barrier to service, we don't have to go through an entire 6-month process to do that. We can just say, hey, here's the money, go do it. And that has proved already to be hugely instrumental in both homelessness and in housing, because if anyone's ever dealt with the city, we're not known for being particularly fast, any city really. So just right off the bat, getting through all those crazy bureaucratic processes like procurement, we don't have to deal with now. We were very careful to not waive the zoning code. Everyone thought immediately, oh, it's just a free-for-all now. You can go out and put a shelter next to a daycare next to... No. What we did instead was say, we will bring to council property by property and waiver requests so that everyone knows what we're doing transparently in the light of day. Of course, there's always backroom politics and all of this. And when the mayor said, I'm going to declare a state of emergency, everyone ran to go find out what that means. And it gives the mayor sweeping powers. We said, no, this isn't a power grab. So we were very deliberate to say, no, the council will be involved. They will know everything that we're up to at the staff level and trying to move these things forward. And absolutely, there will be zoning code changes that are coming. So far, we haven't run into any that we need to. We have about six properties we're looking at right now that will be become either temporary or permanent shelter that will require zone changes. For those who don't know, the city has zoned itself into a box when it comes to things like siting shelter. And that's been going on for years and years, and that's why when you look at Old Town Chinatown, all of our services are there because that's how the zoning code has worked. That's where we can put shelter. The other place that we now have the ability to put shelter, that we have had the ability to put shelter, is in Gateway, because Gateway is a largely unregulated part of the city thus far. And we made the case before we ever got to the state of emergency that if we're not careful, we're going to create another Old Town in Gateway. And if you go ask the folks in Gateway if they want that, they will quickly say no. And that is simply just based on the way that the code reads. And so we have the ability now, and council will say yes when we ask them, to say, okay, we are going to waive this process so we don't have to go through all the hoops and hurdles to cite something, and just go ahead and do it. And so that was the reason to really go ahead and do this, was expedience, and to get through all of the red tape that holds us back. The best part, though, we're working on right now, and people don't generally know this, and nor would you. The mayor and I talked for quite a while before we did this about the idea that this would be a year, and it is for a year, where we're going to experiment. And about halfway through that year, we will sit down with the Planning Bureau and say, okay, these are the things that are working. Go ahead and write the code so that permanently we have the ability to do those things. These are the things we tried and didn't work. Don't write the code to put those in because they're not working. So that we have some time here to really try things and then enshrine them permanently so that we don't keep ending up in these same positions over and over again. And by removing some of the barriers that we've had, largely time, that allows us to try a lot in a very short order.
Next, we will hear Margot Black discussing the concept of material loss of housing with respect to the housing crisis.
That any rent control would have to be enacted by the state, with the exception of a natural or man-made disaster that results in the material elimination of housing. And I don't know the answer to this. I'm very curious as to why both CAT and the city did not view the building-wide evictions and the Airbnb evictions and the demolitions and the, you know, the sort of lack of adequate supply for demand due to the recession, which was certainly a man-made disaster. I mean, there are people who had housing who now do not have housing. To me, that feels like a material elimination of housing, and I'm not sure why we didn't shoot a little stronger there and actually take advantage of the caveat in the Constitution that actually allows us to enact that. And I don't know if that is sort of directed to Katrina or to Josh Alpert, but I'm super curious.
So we definitely had that conversation at CAT, and we believed that it was a perfect example of this material elimination of housing. We didn't know how successful it would be in trying to enact policy that was immediate. And so we made the decision to go for something that has a higher success of being enacted or being addressed in an effective manner than to try to go for rent control, which was such a larger conversation and demanded so much more capacity, which could then mean more people on the streets, which could then mean more people losing housing. And so we tried to think of something that would be most immediate and pressing. And then in addition, we were getting advice from lawyers and legal people at the state level who do have knowledge about this explicit and implicit preemption question, who said, I don't think that it would work.
Yeah, and we clearly had those conversations as well. And in fact, in the city code for natural disasters, rent fixing is mentioned. We had both internal conversations with our lawyers and a lot of conversations with the governor and the state. The way, and I don't want to bog down in technicality, but the way that states of emergency work from a legal framework, from a jurisdiction, the city of Portland can declare a state of emergency, and we kind of make up what that means. In order for the governor to declare Portland a state of emergency, the city has to expend all of its resources first, and then ask the county to ask the governor to declare a state of emergency. For a variety of reasons, and all the conversations we had both with the county and with the state, we chose not to do that. We also were told the same thing that Kat mentioned, that we would have a very slim ability to win a legal challenge, and we knew immediately we would be challenged. In fact, we've already been legally challenged over the renter protection ordinances that have been passed and are currently in courts. So I'm going to be a little bit cagey in some of my answers here. But those conversations did happen, and we made the political calculation to not take up that fight and risk losing and jeopardize the legislative avenue that we are approaching and getting rid of all the preemptions that affect these things so that we can at least have the tools and then decide whether we want to use them or not.
This panel took place on the same night as the Overlook Neighborhood Association meeting, which was where Hazelneck Grove was heavily debated. So here is Vahid Brown talking about Hazelneck Grove.
So there have been unorganized intermittent tent camping at Greeley for years. There has been different, the land is owned by different jurisdictions, so Some of the land is owned by the Union Pacific Railroad, and they would periodically sweep people, tell people they have 24 hours or 48 hours to leave. If their property was still there at the time of the sweep, their property would be confiscated and trashed. Some part of it was owned by ODOT. They would also post periodically. People would camp there and say, you have, 2 weeks or whatever. Again, if you weren't around when the time came, you would lose all of your possessions. Sweeping of the campers happened, again, at different rates, different time frames. There were different levels of discomfort from the different jurisdictions. The city owns part of the land that campers had been on. And when an ODOT sweep was posted for early September, ODOT said they were going to cooperate with the city and sweep both ODOT and city land, the entire area, from between the Greeley Forest Garden and Interstate. And
excuse me, can you explain what ODOT is in case there's anybody that doesn't know what ODOT is?
The Oregon Department of Transportation, ODOT. So that department owned a triangle of the land at the very edge of Greeley and Interstate that they had got from the city when they built the on-ramp to Greeley there. And they just maintained ownership of it. At that same time, there was this discussion in the city and among advocates of a state of emergency. And when Mayor Hales announced that the city would be declaring a state of emergency, would be bringing a state of emergency declaration to council soon, I just sort of asked that the city, I went out to the Grove, brought it to the mayor's attention that there had been a posting sweep. That these people would be swept, they would lose their tents, they would lose their tarps, they would lose potentially their means of livelihood and their means to survive the winter, that it was inconsistent with the city declaring a state of emergency to expose those people to that kind of thing, and that I've appealed to the city to work with us on making a camp there work. And the city responded quite favorably because of what Josh said about the state of emergency allowing the city to experiment. One of the things that we're experimenting on right now is organized tent camping. So the organized part was, the state of emergency allowed us to have some breathing room where we wouldn't have a sweep breathing down the necks of the people camping there. And we were able to sort of come together and say, okay, we're not just going to be a bunch of isolated people in tents. Let's see if we can have a code of conduct, if we can have a way of organizing our resources and our decision-making processes, resolving conflicts. We can have a kind of a way of reaching out to the community. And the community response has been tremendous. There's been a lot of people, volunteers, some of whom are here, who have been regular supporters of the camp. And that's what's allowed it to function, really, is a kind of a community response, organizing among the campers, and the campers advocating for their own interests with the city, and the city working with them. So, I mean, just last night, I was at a meeting with the members of this houseless camp, houseless people who live in tents, able to talk to Josh Alpert about their needs, their concerns, what they want from the city, what the city can or can't give for them. So this is a very different experience for people living on the streets, from being an isolated sort of sidewalk houselessness to being in a community. It's still not housing. It's still not the answer, right? These people, everyone needs to be housed.
Yes.
But this is an improvement that didn't require any city resources, really. It only required really permission and cooperation from the city. And then the houseless people could figure out their own, needs and advocate for their own needs and get transition from there into housing. Eight of the people that were camping at Hazelnut Grove are now inside that's in 3 months. So.
You're listening to portions of a panel that took place on December 16th, 2015 at the Community Warehouse. Up next, you will hear a resident of Yamhill County express her concern about so-called zombie houses and blight, considering that Yamhill County is at 1% availability for rentals. Unused buildings that are becoming broken down was a concern of hers, and this is what the panelists had to say.
Hello, my name is Caroline O'Brien. I'm from McMinnville, Oregon. I apologize for being late, so you may have already addressed this. The reason I'm here is because I live in Yamhill County. I try and go to the Board of Commissioners meetings at the Housing Authority so I can kind of stay on top of things, but your crisis is heading our way. Mm-hmm. We have the Denby bypass going through. We have less than 1% availability right now. And so what's going on now is simply going to become accelerated and it's going to become worse. I noticed from driving through McMinnville, because I'm trying to find a place to live, so that we have empty properties that sit there. With for rent sign, you can't find anything out about the owner, you can't find the property management company, and they're sitting there vacant while people look for homes. So what do you have a suggestion for what I can do to try and build some kind of dialogue between the missing owners of these empty properties, the housing authority, and the people who are looking for a place to live? Where do I start doing something like that? Is starting now better than starting next year?
So this movement is happening in all directions. Mm-hmm. East, southwest.
Yeah. We at the City of Portland are working on a proposal that addresses what we call bank blight, zombie houses, all the houses that now predominantly are east of 82nd. We have 1,000 of them. That we don't know who owns the title, and presumably the banks do. So we've been meeting with the banks. We've been meeting with our auditor, who has under her purview the foreclosure bureau office for the City of Portland, and working out a plan. We're going to start small with a pilot of about 25 houses to actually make sure, one, that there isn't some private owner there that we don't know about, because sometimes that happens, and that two, the banks aren't gonna one day soon wake up and say, oh, actually, you know what, we're gonna fix this house up and put it on the market and sell it. I'm guessing because they've been sitting there empty for about 8 years, that's not gonna happen. We've given them notice to say, either do it or we're taking them. And then we're gonna create a program for first-time home buyers and things that keep it affordable and put those houses back on the market. We have an unbelievable number of houses right now that are sitting empty. So what I would say to you is to find whoever manages within Yamhill County, and it's probably in the county and maybe not in McMinnville, who does the foreclosure process there. Interestingly, and we were a little bit shocked to hear this, City of Portland has not foreclosed on a house in 40 years. And there's a story behind that, and it's a not particularly interesting story about why that happened at the time, when they said, okay, we're never foreclosing again. But we have not actually used that power in 40 years in the City of Portland.
Thank goodness, because it has not been kind to this neighborhood.
I bring that up, and there are many reasons why that's a good policy. But if we don't exercise that muscle every now and then for good, we will never then use it. And when we have all of those empty houses sitting there, if we don't actually start exercising those powers to get them back into city ownership, that's where the blight comes, and that's where neighborhoods start to turn over.
Right, and I guess you're making a distinction between a foreclosure versus taking through eminent domain, So the city is also, we're trying to address some of this, the displacement that's happened in this area in particular, and some of the homes that actually people, families, individuals that have been harmed through those actions, the taking of their homes.
And I also wanted to add a comment on the last discussion that Seattle did an audit of a lot of homes in their community. They found it's massive fraud from the last financial crisis, and they don't know what they're going to do yet, but the potential for actually using eminent domain to pull those back into public housing exists because banks can't find the title for a lot of these housing. So my question is about rent control again, and you've been talking about rent control as an option that might be available to the city if we could have this slew of preemptions lifted. Is rent control on the lifting the preemption, is that on the lobbying agenda for the city? And if it's not, how do we get it there?
We always have on our agenda the lifting of all preemption, just as a blanket policy for the city. This would be every city that I know of. Never wants preemption. We don't like to be told what to do like any other jurisdiction. We have called out specifically, and in fact the number one agenda item for this short session is inclusionary zoning, because we believe if we do this smartly and correctly with advocates that we have a shot at it. What we've been told in terms of rent control is not particularly in a short session should we be bringing that up right now. But inclusionary zoning, everyone knows we're coming for it, so that's where we're putting our resources.
Just to kind of echo what he was saying in terms of CAT's interaction with statewide legislators, we have also heard the same thing, that it may not be necessary necessarily achievable in the short session of 2016, but the conversation has definitely been elevated to a level that is unprecedented.
Rounding out the end of the housing crisis panel in Portland, Oregon, were citizens Charles Johnson and Chloe Udley.
Thank you all for taking time to do this panel and for everyone who's come here. I hope, before I get to the question, that everyone will consider this only a warm-up, because while this is good for us, what we're doing here, it's not enough. We need to do it again before November with Jules Bailey and Ted Wheeler in attendance up front. And we need to have people bring to the table not just the 1,900 or 2,100 or however many people on the street, but also how many people are in the queue. We've had this housing state of emergency. And so one of the questions I want to know is, I guess it's really only the official duty for Mr. Alpert or Mr. Dembro in the audience. Where's the report from Administrative Lead Judge Nan Waller that tells us the actual numbers on no-cause evictions and trends so that we can plan these, you know, even though we are worried that the government response is inadequate, we would like to have some metrics of inadequacy.
There is no data. That's the problem. That's one of the biggest problems in this whole thing, is landlords are not required to file anything with anybody or any kind of notice that they filed a no-cause eviction against a tenant. And so that's also one of the things being discussed at the state level, is do we require that landlords file no-cause evictions so we can start getting metrics, so we can start doing that. But that takes forever. So, yeah,
occupancy.
Push and pull intention.
However, you know, a lot of us in this audience meet the threshold where we have to pay some sort of tax to the state of Oregon, and they, one of the things they do is they finance the data collection system for the courts. So there is data. We know the state of Oregon has a problem with data in the Oracle lawsuit and how the insurance stuff went. But you know, as people, we need to get together and make sure that when we realize, hey people, all of us, we employ 40 attorneys, but they'll only do what the mayor says, because they're the city attorneys like Jim Rice, and they're busy keeping Ms. Haynes from getting her settlement in front of a hung jury. But the point is that earlier we talked about the short session. We, as the people, need to get up in this line and still generate the questions of, what are the real reasons that Mr. Dembro and Mr. Shields and Ms. Kotek didn't do anything in the last legislature when we wanted to get the inclusionary zoning? And how can we say preemption is an issue, because it's been here eternally, it didn't go away in the last long session? So people, keep get in line, repeat the question until they do something about how is preemption going to end for the minimum wage. How is preemption going to end for inclusionary zoning and rent control? Thank you.
My name's Chloe. I admin a Facebook group called That's a Goddamn Shed. Some of us are here. Yay, Charles. And today I started another page called Friends of Oregon Renters 4, and I'm trying to gather renters from across the state to bring pressure to bear on their representatives, because I think all our mayors and representatives from urban areas get that there's a crisis, but outside of that area in more rural Oregon, I don't doubt that it's affecting them, but for whatever reason, we don't have their support, and we really need their support. Mm-hmm. I was at the very confusing and disappointing Oregonian forum on the rent crisis last week. Anyone else? Is anyone else there? Yeah, we had two developers on that panel that had nothing to do with rental housing. One of them didn't have anything to do with housing at all. Dan Saltzman and great woman from Thousand Friends of Oregon and Sam from Multnomah County. And I, when asked the question, does everyone on the panel believe that housing is a human right? I think everyone's hands shot up except for Justin Wood from Fish Construction and the Housing Home Builders Association. Maybe I was focusing my laser beams too hard on Justin Wood to notice what anyone else on that panel was doing, but he kind of sheepishly put his hand up and said, well, I mean, we can say housing is a human right, but not everyone has a right to live in Manhattan.
He said it was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, he said it was a rhetorical question? Okay, I'd forgotten about that part. But I guess, I'm sorry. I would like to hear from the panel what housing as a human right means to you, because that's an idea that we're hearing more and more, but is being given very little explanation. And there was so much misinformation spread on that panel last week about inclusionary zoning, rent control, which, by the way, Justin Wood, Fish Construction, supports overturning the rent control ban. So when we get to that, we should definitely, you know, ask him for some donations. Yes. If housing is a human right, that means that our government and our communities have an obligation to provide it, and we are failing to provide it. So, we can't all live in Manhattan, but hopefully we can all live with a roof over our heads in the city we've chosen to live in. And I'm just wondering if any of you guys can expand or elaborate on that idea of it being a human right.
Been working in affordable housing for pretty much 50 years. I would say that food, clothing, housing, education are all human rights. Do we all have access to them equally? No, we don't. It's the reality out there. Do I believe it's a human right? For sure. I'm a human. I want to live in a house and I want to go out there. And in an affordable housing business, we are always looking for ways of not just giving housing to people, but giving them the tools to better themselves. Affordable housing should be a way for families to the next level.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It should be security for a couple of years for them to move to their own home. To have their kids educated. Yes.
Thank you. And Josh?
A couple of things. One, everyone, housing, of course, is a human right. So is having a roof over your head, and those are different things. Everyone has the right to have a roof over their head, and everyone has the right to have housing. Shelter is not the answer. Shelter provides a roof over people's head, and everyone should have access to that, but everyone also should have access to housing, permanent housing. We have seen clearly, and I know everyone for some reason thinks this is a new phenomenon in Portland, housing first. Portland's been doing that for decades, and we do it because it works. If you can get housing, your other problems then become front and center, and you can start addressing them. But until you have that housing, you can't. The barriers are just too great. I spent a day shadowing some folks who live on the street and just following them through their daily life just to see what happens in our system here. And these are people with no roof over their head whatsoever. And they spent the entire day waiting in line here, waiting in line there. Nobody walking up and down the line, triaging, saying, hey, did you get your flu shot? Hey, have you? Nothing. The system is so inefficient that they don't have time to look for jobs. There's no job searching when all you're doing is waiting in line for a shower, waiting in line for your food, waiting in line to meet with your caseworker. Who can do anything? When you have housing, that part is done, and you can spend your day looking for a job or going to the doctor, doing the things that we all take for granted, or most of us take for granted in our daily lives. So without housing, human life can't really happen. And people on the streets make the most of it, and it's incredible to me that when I'm out at Hazelnut Grove or just walking down the street, the people are smiling. I mean, they know that their life is not what it should be, and yet they're making the most of it. When they have housing, that's when their life really can start.
Thank you.
I think, first of all, housing is a human right means that for all the folks that are outside, the people that we see on the streets, that we recognize that they are humans, that the recognition of the humanity of the people outside is the first thing to recognizing that they have a human right to being housed. And that it's unacceptable that there's 2,000 people in the city of Portland living in the streets. That's unacceptable. It's not okay. It isn't okay for any of us. It's not okay for any of us. So the government, the city of Portland, the county, the federal government, they have responsibilities that they are not meeting. They have responsibilities towards those people, and we need to personally advocate that they take up those responsibilities, but we also need to do other things. It's on all of us, and it's not okay that there are 2,000 people sleeping on the sidewalk, sleeping in tents in the rain, sleeping in the mud, that don't have access to a lifestyle other than standing in line all day to get a shower, only to find that you didn't make it, and so you spent your entire day standing on the sidewalk to get a shower, and your shower ended up being the rain that fell on you that day. That isn't acceptable. So you know, as a community, we need to be creative. We need to be entrepreneurial. We need to be like bold. We need to be in solidarity and in community with the people that are living on the streets. They are human beings. They are our neighbors. They are our community, and they need us.
Thank you. Katrina?
Yeah, so I definitely have to echo what everyone on the panel has said thus far. And I would like to add that when I hear housing is a human right, it means to me that housing is not a commodity. Housing is not something that housing is not something that should be used for the sole purpose of generating profit on money. Because yes, it is the foundation of human life. I would also say that it means housing as a human right means that everybody has to have access to it. Everybody. I also think that it means that not only the government, but private actors who are also humans have a responsibility to meet that need. So the developers, the landlords, the homeowners, etc., also have a responsibility to meet the housing need. Housing is a human right.
Thank you. Housing is a human right. Your quick thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly agree. How to implement that in practice is tricky. I echo what Katrina said in that we have to separate it from being a vehicle of wealth and investment. I think it needs to be thought of as a vehicle of wealth and investment for a community, not for an individual and for corporations. I think, in terms of who deserves to live in Manhattan or in trendy neighborhoods in Portland or in, fancy houses in Irvington, I think we have to stop talking about, what someone has done in their life to deserve to live in fancy neighborhoods. Everybody deserves housing. I think that if we really focus on communities and community developments, right now we have people living in one neighborhood because the property taxes are so cheap, and then driving their kids, 60 minutes across town to the best school in another neighborhood, and working somewhere else, and we need to just really get people back into their communities. They need to live where they work. They need to support their public schools. They need to support their local businesses. They need to know their neighbors so that they care about them when their neighbors are displaced, so that their neighbors aren't displaced. And then as those communities grow, those community centers grow, and the access to housing grows, I just think that there's enough room for everybody, and we just have to, treat it like we just have to find the resources to make sure everybody has the housing. And I think that it is going to be, I mentioned earlier that, having a poor rent history might preclude somebody from getting into housing. I think if people have housing and feel secure in that and stable in that, and don't feel dehumanized and infantilized by being, just a renter, I don't think we're going to have
people who aren't taking care of their housing, because they're going to be invested in their communities and they're going to be invested in the place where, that they live and care about. So.
1940s, and things were changing fast. It was the straw that broke the back. The bottle was uncorked. They started organizing meetings, the tenant farmers of New York. They found the strength of numbers. They found the power of suggestion. They found each other asking the same question. Who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man?
All right, well, that brings that piece to a close. Thanks to KBOO volunteer Kristen Yount for recording that panel called A Rent Crisis, A People's Perspective. It was coverage of the December 16th People's Panel sponsored by Know Your City and Portland Tenants Unite. We're going to move on to music for the afternoon. Nick Geffro is here to bring you a special edition, very special edition of Jazz Lives. People are assembling here in the studio to make it a very special afternoon. Hope you can all stay tuned for that immediately following the KBOO Noon News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running from January 15th through February 8th. Real Music explores the lively interplay between sound and image, music and culture. Opening night, January 15th, will be Roxy the Movie, directed by Frank Zappa. Filmed over three nights in December 1973 at the Roxy Theater in Hollywood, Roxy the Movie encapsulates the qualities that made Frank Zappa a revolutionary musical pioneer. That's January 15th at 9:15 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.